Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of February. We're going to have a lot of fun this hour. Our guest is the author of White House Chef, 11 years, two presidents, one kitchen. Walter Scheib is with us, and Walter was the White House chef for all of those years and has very interesting stories to tell about how the food that is served by the White House gives people an impression of what America is. He has great stories to tell about the Bushes and the Clintons and the people he was able to serve and how you prepare for all these state dinners and people showing up 25 on the spur of the moment and how you cook and what the kitchen looked like and what statements were being made by these administrations when they chose certain kinds of food. It's just a great read. Plus, there are recipes in the book. Chef Walter Scheib graduated with highest honors from the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. He went to the Capitol Hilton, became executive chef, and then to the Boca Raton Club and Resort. From Florida to White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia in 1990, where he was executive chef at Greenbrier. And then in 1994, and this is a great story of how he was selected, because there were like thousands of people who wanted to be the White House chef, and they chose Walter. We'll talk about why. He was selected to join the staff of the executive residence at the White House in 94 as executive chef. So he was in charge of managing and preparing all menus and meals for the first family, also their private entertaining, and the official and state functions of the presidency. And he also did the same for the Bushes until he was let go in 2005, I believe it was. Well, here's our phone number. Whenever you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Hello, Chef.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Well, not as cold as you guys are, apparently.
Yeah, we are really cold. But that's, you know, what I've been doing is eating. People do that when it's cold. I just eat all the time.
Well, I think it's a primal sub hibernation, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right. Eat and then go to sleep. But we got to work in the meantime. Tell us the story, because it's really a moving story as well of how you became White House chef. Your mom was such a big fan, and she helped you go to school and really was an inspiration to you. And you're coming back from her funeral, I believe, when shortly thereafter you learned about the opening in the White House.
Yeah, that's true. I was coming back, and, again, as you say, it's almost a cliche, but you know, I learned to cook at my mother's knee, as it were. She was a tremendous hobbyist chef, so I owe her everything I have in terms of getting into the business. But my wife and I were coming back from San Diego where we had just had the funeral, and curiously enough, if you're into sort of these quasi-surreal things, she finds, my wife finds a piece of newspaper stuck between the fuselage and the seat of the plane, and it's...
Oh my gosh!
New York Times on a flight from San Diego, who knew? And it says, you know, White House chef resigns, and she goes, you know, you should apply for that position. So no, you know, I think not, Gene. It's, you know, I got a great job where I am. I'm quite happy, and you know, obviously my mother just passed, and not thinking about making a whole lot of moves right now. But being stuck on a plane flight with an alpha female for the next 6 hours, my will wore down, and finally ended up having to say no. You know, that's it. That's final. And as most women will recognize, that's when the men have just surrendered. When they say that's final.
Of course, yeah.
So the next morning, I came down to go to work, and she had dusted off the resume and put together a cover letter and said, you know, I need you to sign this before you go in today. So she sent it off, and a couple days later, I followed up with a phone call and got a nice woman in what's called the usher's office, which is the sort of the business manager of the White House. And I said, you know, my name is Walter Scheib. I'm at the Greenbrier. I'm applying for the White House chef's job. I just wanted to see if you'd see my resume. And the woman just started laughing. I said, well, was it West Virginia or my name? You know, what's so funny? She goes, oh, no, don't take it personally. There are, you know, about 4,000 applicants.
Oh,
we have literally
boxes
and boxes of them sitting here. I said, well, you know, that may be true, but you need to dig through and find mine. I think I might be the kind of guy you'd be looking for. So a couple hours later, I get a phone call from the chief usher, and he says, yeah, you are, in fact. And this started probably 2 or 3 weeks of a series of interviews and culminating with the opportunity to actually cook for the First Lady in her inner circle, which she called Hillary Land, which is probably 8 or 10 most trusted aides. And so I did a dinner for them, or actually it was a lunch. But, you know, how we actually did that was kind of curious. I asked the usher, well, what should I serve? Anything you want.
That's good advice.
As many as you want. Basically, wouldn't tell you anything. So you basically have to go out and try to find out, you know, what, you know, for the most important job in your life. You have no parameters and just kind of wing it. And thankfully, it worked out well. At the end of the meal, I got a chance to come in. And first thing you do is you look at the plates as a chef. You always look to see if the plates are empty. Well, that's always a good sign. If they're not, well, you might have trouble. But they were all clean as a whistle. And the First Lady said, you know, that was the, you know, I love lamb, and that was the best lamb I've ever had. So, well, there's one point. She says, well, tell us about your menu, chef. And I say, well, you know, these are all wonderful plates, but they weren't designed to be just restaurant plates. They were designed to be served for 200 or 300. And you can almost see a little spark in her eye.
Oh, very clever of you, Walter.
She says, why did you say that? None of the other chefs have mentioned that. I said, well, you're looking for a chef to do steak dinners, aren't you? She goes, yes, you are. I said, well, this is what I wanted to show you. It's what you've been looking for, according to all the press. She goes, you know, you're the first chef that mentioned that. So left the room, didn't know if I was going to get the job or not, but knew that clearly had made an impression and piqued her interest. So a couple of days later, I got a phone call to come on back, and I thought it was just for more interviews, and end up sitting next to the First Lady in the private residence in a little living room area, and she's reading off this sort of mandate that she wants to see to highlight American cuisine at the White House. And after about 40 minutes of this, everybody comes swirling in, and they're all saying, we need this menu, we need that menu, we need to get ready for this reception. I said, kind of thing, well, this is strange, you know. Finally, I turned to Mrs. Clinton. I said, you know, I don't mean to be impertinent, ma'am, but, you know, nobody said yet, would you like the job? And she just rolls her head back. She's got this great laugh that she has, and she says, oh, Walter, you're going to have to get used to how we do things here in Washington. We always get it just a little bit backwards. Do you want the bloody job or not? I said, yes, ma'am. And so that started 11 great years, you know, the personal honor of getting to serve the first families and the professional challenge of bringing American food to the White House.
Yeah. And she had a definite we learn a lot about what she wanted in the White. She wanted to really highlight vegetables and American foods and healthy foods. Is it true that before that we'd been heavy with French sauces and lots of calories?
Well,
in the White
I wouldn't
House?
Characterize it necessarily as French, but the food had been European style. The last major change at the White House was when Jackie Kennedy was there. She brought a wonderful chef named Rene Verdun, who brought tremendous European style gourmet food to the White House. So that was sort of one of the sea changes. But in the late 70s in California and areas around the country, this new American cuisine was given birth, and it was really driven by wonderful, great, seasonally fresh ingredients. Mm. And then as this idea moved around the country, it picked up regional influences, you know, whether it's the Pacific Northwest or the Southwest U.S. or the Cajun or Upper Midwest, any of the areas, all great chefs started to kick their 2 cents in as this cuisine started to grow. And then finally, as the demographics of the population has changed over the last 25 years, many people have brought new ingredients and cooking techniques and flavor combinations. So by the late 80s, early 90s, the American cuisine had really developed to the point where it was no longer this fledgling cuisine. It was full-grown and ready to sit at the adult table, if you will. And so Mrs. Clinton, and I think any First Lady would have done the same thing, but she just happened to be there, decided that she wanted to bring this great American cuisine to the White House. And so that gets us to the point where she's put out the word in the street that she's looking for the American chef, and that's how I find myself on an airplane flying home from California.
Yeah. And you eventually built a garden on the White House roof, didn't you?
Well, there had always been a little bit of a garden up there, and there's an herb garden in the residence itself, but we discovered, as I was saying about American cuisine, it's all about having great, great, great ingredients. And so Mrs. Clinton one time, you know, when I was first there for a couple of months, asked, you know, could I get just for tomorrow for lunch, very simple, all I want is a ripe tomato salad. And, of course, in Washington in late July, there's tomatoes everywhere, everybody's backyard, they're growing, and it's just a wonderful time of year for them. I said, sure, no problem. So go to the purchasing guy, say, I need some tomatoes for the First Lady tomorrow. Comes back the next day with these terrible little kind of pink, horrible-looking grocery store tomatoes. And I said, well, Bill, what are those? You know, I can't serve those to the First Lady. They're awful. And we need luscious, ripe, delicious tomatoes. And the guy looked at me in all seriousness, and he says, well, you know, chef, if you'd wanted ripe, you should have written ripe on the requisition. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So I did two things. One was to put ripe on the left-hand column of all the requisitions and Xerox them off, and that became the status. But we developed a fuller service garden on the roof. And the call it a garden kind of overstates that it was a sort of a greenhouse situation. We had peppers and squashes and tomatoes and zucchinis and these sorts of things. And they would be started over at the National Arboretum and then brought over as they were finished. So from probably April to October, we would have wonderful fresh produce for the First Lady grown right on the roof.
As somebody who has a hard time just preparing dinner, I'm not a cook, but your job, I look at your job description and it just is flabbergasting. You have all the menus and the meals for the first family. You got their private entertaining. And then you have these huge official and state functions. What a job this is. And you didn't make that much money.
Well, you know, it really wasn't about the money. And Mrs. Clinton, when she hired me, said, aren't you even going to ask how much you get paid? I said, you know, I'll do it free. It's just a great adventure. But it's a government job, and so it is what it is. But you get the opportunity to serve the first family. But you're right. We served everything from a bag of popcorn for a movie up to a state dinner for 900 people.
Wow.
Picnics for five, 6,000 people.
Mm.
And all of it out of a kitchen that's only about 30 feet by 30 feet. So
we had
a whole lot of logistical dilemmas to fight through and rebuild the kitchen and rebuild the staff and figure out alternate ways to do things. But we did it all ourselves. We never brought caterers in from the outside. So that was one of the goals I had set for myself personally, is that if we're going to do this, we're going to do it all ourselves. We're going to do it correctly.
But you worked so hard, Walter, didn't you? You got up at the crack of dawn. You had to get there bright and early. You got the breakfast to deal with and all these meals.
Well, I tell you, if you've been in the food beverage business or cooking in particular, you know that that's that kind of de rigueur. It comes with the territory. But we were always there. Somebody was there from about an hour before the first family would get up until about, when they retired, or about a half an hour after they retired for the evening. So for the Clintons, that meant somebody had to be there by 5:30 and somebody would be there till, gosh, who knows when, midnight, 12:30. And then with the Bushes, President got up very early, so I used to have to be on the floor by about 20 after 4 in the morning.
Ooh.
And somebody would be there till about 11 o'clock at night.
Ooh.
But you're there. Our only goal, the White House isn't a hotel or a restaurant. It's a private home. So our one and only goal was to make sure that the first family got taken care of and was given sort of a little island of normalcy in a crazy, crazy sea.
Yeah. And the sea got crazier as the years went on.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about who decides, and did you for both administrations do a weekly plan of menus? This is what the family's going to eat, and who would you work that out with?
Well, typically, you would spend the first couple of months working with the new first lady, figuring out what their personal tastes were. And a lot of times you'll ask somebody, well, what do you like? And they'll say X. And then it turns out by watching when you serve X that they don't really like it at all. they may not even know their own taste. So as you develop your repertoire of what they enjoy and what they don't enjoy, we would put together menus probably about a week in advance that would sort of outline the upcoming week for the family. And it wasn't just the ingredients and the items that were on it. We would put a nutritional breakdown of fat grams, calories, salt, all the wonderful things that people need to know. And that both first ladies were very, very conscious of the nutritional component of dining. So we were also, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was anything that the family didn't like, typically, you'd find out about it pretty quickly, and you'd just drop that from your repertoire.
Just look at that plate, see if they ate it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I tell you, if you look 4 days in a row and there's carrots on the plate, and you probably get the idea that the carrots may not be their big favorite.
Did you travel with both families as well?
I tell you, it depended. By law, we weren't able to travel with them for personal use or personal service. We had to be going along if there was a government function or a state function that took place. So the answer is yes. We went to Camp David very, very frequently. Also traveled to New York, traveled to Miami to do the Summit of the Americas, went to Denver to do the G8, and a variety of other smaller venues around the country.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about September 11, because it really it changed the nature of the work that you did. I was so struck by your description of that day in the book, Walter, and getting out of the residence and looking at planes and thinking they were heading for you. And then you had to be very careful because people could be trying to poison the family.
Well,
you had to
clearly
be careful about food and everything.
Yeah, clearly 9/11 changed changed the entire country, but in a small way changed how we were able to do business.
Yeah.
First and foremost, obviously, it restricted the number of people that we could have come to work. We had frequently had a lot of people had sort of nominal security clearance. After 9/11, they had to get the full security clearance. That restricted the ways that we could buy food and the places we could get them from. But more than that, it really restricted the attitude towards entertaining. Obviously, it's very inappropriate to have, lavish or gala parties when the whole country is, on a war footing, as they were. So that changed everything. And on top of that, it really was a very somber mood for the first year or 6 months to a year in the house personally. So a lot more comfort foods, a lot less of the entertaining, a lot more close to the vest. Still very busy, lots of business lunches and these sorts of things plans are being discussed. But it really took a lot of the fun out of it, to be honest with you. And I think in many respects, that may have been the beginning of wanting to move on to the next challenge. It really wasn't a whole lot of fun after 9/11. But the curious thing was the day that 9/11 took place, we were supposed to have a congressional picnic for like 3,000 people on the grounds that evening. So we ended up, obviously, we didn't have a picnic, but we did end up serving from probably about 3 o'clock in the afternoon till about 11 o'clock at night, a constant parade of Army and Secret Service and National Guard guys and police, and just basically fed them all the food that we were supposed to have fed at the picnic. And it was really curious because even at the worst of times, people always think about food. I can just remember these guys lining up and saying, "Chef, this is the best beef we've ever had. What have you done?" I said, "Guys, eat all you want. Keep whoever the heck's on the outside, and you can come in and eat all the beef you want."
Oh.
So it was curious. Got home that night, and I think I just smelled like smoke from having cooked steaks for 6 or 8 hours. And my wife's, you know, are you okay? Are you all right? All the kids want to know is, Daddy, did you see lots of guns?
Oh.
It's like, oh, boys, you don't know the guns I've seen today.
Yeah, really, you sure don't. And then you had to change, because talk about how you had to change your procedures for getting food. Sometimes they were sent to you. You had to be very careful about anthrax and all
know,
that.
It's always, you know, I can't get too deeply into how they do it because a lot of procedures are still in place. But suffice it to say that nothing that we can't trace all the way back to where it came from and who it came from. Most of our purchasing is anonymous. We go out and select things on our own. Nothing that's sent in unsolicited is ever used, and a variety of other things, which unfortunately I can't say. But obviously, all the chefs preparing the food, we would taste everything before it went upstairs. So clearly, we had a vested interest above and beyond even keeping the president healthy. We'd like to keep ourselves healthy, too.
Right,
so
right.
We were very, very cautious, and the supply line security was the real key to that.
Yeah. You mentioned comfort foods. You have a wonderful description of when Mrs. Clinton was out on the road and came back and she was exhausted, and you knew just what to do. You knew how to read people, which is a big part of the job.
Well, I'll tell you, when you're working directly for, you know, as I say, it's not a hotel or a restaurant, it's a private home, and your clientele is just the family and their extended family and guests. So you really get to know them very well. And Mrs. Clinton had come in off the road. She'd been out, I think, 2 weeks in Europe or Africa, I can't recall where, but was clearly just run down and tired. And, you know, the entire house kind of reflects the mood of the First Lady. So the entire house was sort of glum and a little bit sour. Looked at this, I said, you know, we've got to do something. We've got to try to find a way to cheer her up. So I looked around, and Mrs. was always, you know, very nutritionally oriented in her food, salads and lots of vegetables, very healthy dining. I said, we got to change this up. So I went downstairs to the staff dining room that day, and curiously enough, they were serving great American favorite fajitas, you know, something in our wildest dreams we'd never think to serve the First Lady. But we found an old cast iron pan and got all the components set up and went up to the kitchen on the second floor, and as the butler was getting ready to go into the room with his hot pan, squeeze the lime juice, big cloud of steam, and the
Ooh.
First lady's, what's this? So she ate the whole thing up, and then you could hear her laughing, and she was carrying on, and then about an hour later, she calls downstairs. She says, Walter, you know, I'm always really big on nutrition, and, you know, it's very important to how we dine and the whole deal, but sometimes you just need something good, and that was just good.
Exactly.
The rest of the day was a little bit more lighthearted, but it is interesting how to see, you know, even the most important people in the world, they still are motivated by the same instincts that the rest of the world is.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Walter. He's the author of White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents, One Kitchen. Walter Scheib is our guest. He's been on a lot of television. You probably saw him, those of you who watched The Daily Show, he was on last night as well. So he's making the rounds here. The book is just a real interesting look at the Clinton kitchen and also the Bush kitchen. He spent 11 years, and we'll have to ask him if it's unusual to carry on with another administration once you've been with one for a long period of time. He looks at the more personal side of his job. He looks at some of the major events that took place, like September 11 when he was the chef. He looks at, and we have yet to talk about these, holidays at the White House, what he considered one of his, well, several of his more remarkable years. He has some interesting things to say about Chelsea Clinton, and he taught her how to cook before she went off to college, and his departure from the White House. So all of that. Feel free to join us, 800-486-8655. The book also has recipes in it as well. 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Walter Scheib is our guest, White House chef for 11 years. He now runs the American Chef, which is a company offering catering, cooking classes, and culinary talks that draw on his White House experiences. It's a lovely book, 11 Years, Two Presidents, One Kitchen. And we welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you want to join us, it might be, you know, you may want to ask something, you know, what were comfort foods for the different administrations, what the bosses were like, you know, all of that. He has just had some remarkable experiences. And so join us, or we'll just talk. That's okay, too, if it's that kind of conversation. In Milwaukee, the number is 227-2050, 227-2050 for you to join our conversation. I think this is real nice, and there's a little thank you note from her that you taught should be a nice gift for people going off to college. You taught Chelsea Clinton and some friends how to cook before she went off to school. That was really nice.
Well, by her senior year in high school, Chelsea had taken on a full-fledged, full-blown vegetarian lifestyle. So we had to sort of reteach ourselves first in the kitchen, you know, what it was to do a vegetarian diet. and not just for one course, you know, where you produce a plate of steamed vegetables or whatever, but to actually have it be three meals a day and to be not only flavorful but nutritionally responsible, that she wouldn't get run down or sick. So we had to teach ourselves first. But that summer, before Chelsea was getting ready to go off to Stanford, Mrs. Clinton asked, you know, basically, we'd like her to stay in her apartment, not have to go out and draw press when she goes out to eat. So could you teach her how to cook? So Chelsea and one of her friends spent a couple days a week for about 6 weeks with us, a couple hours a day, actually learning the rudiments of how to do vegetarian cooking, from, you know, the basics of knife cutting and product identification right up to doing all the soups and sauces and entrees. And she was so happy with a lot of things that she made that on many, many occasions she'd ask me, well, can we serve that to the family tonight so I can basically get some bragging rights on it. And at the end of the 6 weeks, we had a chef's coat made for us at First Daughter, and the calligraphers made up a nice certificate saying,
oh,
graduate White House Vegetarian Cooking School.
Oh, so great.
But she was a real sweetheart, as were the Bush girls. And she was kind enough, you know, didn't have to. I think what I would have done at 17 if I had all those people working for me. But sent a nice note saying, really, thanks for the time. And, you know, I think I really learned something. So it's good to be of service. It's even better to teach somebody something.
Yeah. Do you know if she's still a vegetarian?
You know, I don't know. Obviously, the Clintons are as busy as anybody in the world. Chelsea's up in New York somewhere now, as I understand it. I have had a chance to see the president and Mrs. Clinton on and off over the years. But, you know, the topic never really turned to that.
Mm-hmm. But there was an emphasis, and is this true on both administrations? I know Mrs. Clinton wanted there to be not a whole lot of red meat on the menu. She had quite a few meals, as I look at your menus, that were meatless.
Yeah, we really tried to go that way. Again, you know, you can't have the dinners being Sunday dinner every night of the week, if you will, because God knows they'll blow up like balloons.
Sure.
You really have to keep we really like fresh vegetables and fresh fruits. Again, as I say, American cuisine really is driven by great flavors, and we found out that this was a great way to get flavors in. If you went down to the market and found out was the best and most unique at that time and used that, you were halfway home. I mean, if you asked the folks that listen in, what's the greatest flavor or greatest thing you ever ate, they're going to say it was a strawberry in May, or it was a tomato in August, or a peach in July.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those things had any preparation at all. It was just something that's delightful and beautiful and lush and rich. And that's a lot of the cuisine I do is really based on keeping those intense flavors and not masking them. I think God's a better cook than I am, so I let him do his thing, and we just try to accentuate.
Let's go to Kay from Madison. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask about President Clinton in particular, because he was known for wanting to stop and get a real big
right.
burger, you know. And you mentioned about his Mrs. Clinton wanting healthier meals, but did you have some particular ways that you fed President Clinton, and what were some of his?
Oh, yes, he did.
when the first lady was in residence, they whether it was Mrs. Bush or Mrs. Clinton, they called the tune. Believe me, but when the presidents would get wind that the first lady was going out of town or going to travel, the word would come down through the butlers, you know, basically tear up the menu for the week and break out the good stuff, you know. So I think in many respects the food at the White House didn't divide along party lines as much as it did gender lines. And again, as I said, First Lady's very eclectic and very adventurous palates. I think the both presidents would have been just as happy if we'd opened up a burger joint in the basement. And they kind of dined on the concept that if it was good, it was better with melted cheese. So.
And tell me, you would serve them occasionally. They'd be working. You'd serve them lunch. What did Clinton like to eat for lunch, and what does Bush like to have for lunch?
Well, President Clinton didn't come back to residence often for lunch. He pretty much took his lunches over in the Oval Office, which was served by the Navy Mess, which is actually a naval cooking facility that's one floor down over in the Oval Office. But President Bush loved to come back to the residence. He would do a workout, you know, do his track work or running every day between 12 and 1. And, you know, basically, if you had a peanut butter and honey, a grilled cheese sandwich, a hamburger, and a BLT, you had basically covered his entire culinary universe. And so we would basically stand by. At first, I didn't really get it. And he would ask for something different each day. And it became kind of apparent that he was almost teasing with me to see if he could, you know, get me to go downstairs and get something else. So after a while, we just made all four of them, kept them, and whatever it was he'd ask for. It's like, oh, no, sir, we got this. Oh, we'll have the other one then. Oh, okay, that'll be a second, sir, and we'll just go ahead. But that was kind of a repertoire. He was a funny, funny guy privately. And, you know, half the time he'd be going, hey, Cookie, what do we got for lunch today? You know, it was very, very familiar.
That was your nickname, Cookie.
On occasion. Mostly it was Walter Chef. But if he was in a particularly good mood, you reverted to Cookie. And in Washington, if you've got a presidential nickname, you're on the A-list. So that's good.
That's right. Thanks, Kay, for the call. Sean is next from Baraboo. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello, Chef.
How are you?
Very nice to imagine what it must smell like and taste like. around you, I suppose I'd say. But you know, when you mentioned you made the great beef for the people that didn't show up for, you know, on 911.
Right. And
what was it about that beef? Because, you know, everyone barbecues, right?
Yep.
You're standing there with your expertise. What made that beef so special?
Well, I'll tell you. I think, you know, one thing was cookout, and we had a nice spice rub on it, and we had a marination on it. But really, I think all good dining comes from the surroundings and the people you're with. The food is, you know, fourth or fifth on the list. And I think what really made it good to these guys is that they're out there on the front lines with the guns, not knowing what the heck's happening, and the opportunity to get to come back inside and actually get something delicious and hot, and, you know, a great meal as opposed to a typical military meal, I think was what really made it special for them.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go to theamericanchef.com, there's a variety of recipes. One of the barbecue sauces that we use is on there in the archives.
Great. Yeah, people would love to do that. Or we should tell people there are recipes in the book, too. How did you decide what to put in there, Walter?
Well, actually, Andrew Friedman, the co-author, who really is a genius, he's the one that made the book sound the way it does. It sounds, people have told me it sounds like me speaking, and he's put my voice in it. But when we started out on the book, we didn't want to do just a standard cookbook. We didn't want to say, okay, well, here's 500 recipes. What we wanted to do is come up with the 40 or 50 best stories that we could think of, and then bring recipes out of those stories rather than, you know, the best recipes. And so what happened is, coming out of these stories, we have everything from the president's snack mix right up to a state dinner from Mexico and everything in between. So we really didn't sit down and say, okay, well, here's 10 beef and 10 lamb and 10 fish and 15 salads and 20 soups.
Mm-hmm.
We really said, what are the best stories we have that'll really give the public an insight to the First Families, not as the cartoon characters they're portrayed at in the press or in the media, but really as human beings and let people get a glimpse at what it was like to actually live in the White House.
Yeah. Thanks, Sean, for the call. We go next to Paul from Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello, Chef.
How are you?
I saw you on The Daily Show last night. I've worked as a retired caterer. I worked with a number of executive chefs, and some were haughty and some were nice. And I always like the nice ones better. My question to you is, anybody's been in that business for any length of time has had a near disaster that they pulled out. And I'd like to swap a war story with you. I'm sure you've got a good one, and I've got a good one. You go first.
Well, okay, no problem. Well, I'll tell you, most of the state dinners, there was never any problem with them. They were more like Broadway plays than actual dinners in that you had a month to rehearse them, refine them, and get the logistics nailed down and all that. But there was one time, and it was for, again, a large picnic, supposedly for the Washington Press Corps, but at those, Congress always attends also. So for whatever reason, we were supposed to have 2,800 people. And Congress was supposed to be 1,000 of those. But for whatever reason, Newt Gingrich decided he didn't want to send he was holding votes late so the people couldn't attend. So it looked like we were going to only have 1,800 people, and we've got all this food. So one of the people in the social office got the bright idea, let's go over to the executive office and get all the volunteers, 1,000 volunteers. So the 1,000 volunteers come pouring over, and these are all like 22, 23-year-old kids, and they're starving. And suddenly here comes Congress, too. So now we've got 3,800 people. So we've got it's not a big hotel. It's a little kitchen, as I said. So we got 1,000 more people than we thought were going to be there. So we're scrambling around trying to literally gather anything that was edible, lettuces, noodles, beans, you name it, and trying to get it cooked up and then get it in some sort of salad configuration, you know, marinations and vinaigrettes and such. So we have this giant mixing bowl that was about 6 feet across, about 4 feet deep, that we're just mixing everything on the south grounds. And so I've got my big rubber gloves on, and we're doing this. And the butler comes over and says, Chef, there's somebody here to see you. I said, well, Jim, can't you see I'm busy? I can't work now. He says, oh, no, she says she's from the New York Times. I was like, uh-oh. They look up, and it's a woman who I've got to know very well over the years now. Her name was Marion Burroughs, who at that time was the Washington correspondent to the food section of the New York Times. And she sees the White House chef up to his elbows in the salad bowl. And I swear, you could put a division of Marines between us. She knew there was a story here, and she was going to get it. So having to explain to her what it was all about and saying, look, you know, it probably wouldn't reflect well on the First Lady. How would you like to attend a state dinner? And she said she bought it. The story didn't make the paper, but that was as close to a real debacle as we ever had.
Yeah.
It sounds like a good save.
Yes.
My big disaster was, or near disaster, I'm happy to say that I never had a fallout disaster. We were doing a real elegant wedding luncheon, and this was in Denver, by the way. My company competed against you for the, I don't know if we competed, but for the G8 dinner.
That didn't turn out well, did it?
Excuse me?
No, that didn't work out for you, did it?
No, it probably wasn't even likely. But at any rate, we were doing this elegant outdoor seated luncheon in Denver with round tables with umbrellas. It was a hot August afternoon, and we had all the tables set and ready to go. And just before we were to announce lunch, this downdraft of wind kicked up and blew all of the umbrella tables and all of the you know, china and silverware and everything, glassware. Fortunately, our main shop wasn't too far away, and we hadn't served yet, so we had to really quickly turn it into a buffet.
That's the beauty of our business.
That's quite a story. Thanks so much, Paul, for your call. Let's talk about the press a little bit more. You talk early in the book about, obviously, you know, you're the stuff of juicy gossip, and people are interested in what people are eating in the First Family's dining quarters, et cetera. So the press is interested in talking to you, and you learned early on how much you should say and how much you shouldn't say, right?
Well, and that's a lesson well learned and quickly learned, and the answer is you say nothing if you're able. I learned the hard way that you know, that if you speak to the press, that they really aren't your friends, and in many cases, no offense here, this is just what it's like to be on the inside of the house,
sure.
That they, in many cases, the story is sort of pre-written. They're looking for you to fill in some quotes, and quite honestly, the White House press office was very, very adamant that we not speak to the press. But the first couple of weeks, as I was learning how to handle this, just a firestorm of people around you and, you know, and asking you questions and trying to get you to say things. And sure enough, I managed to say something that was luckily not ever printed. And I likened one of the reasons I was happy to be leaving West Virginia is I said, well, you know, our kids are getting ready to go to school, and schools here are not the best. They're kind of like Arkansas
Uh-oh.
Or Tennessee.
Uh-oh.
And I was like, oh, my goodness.
Uh-oh, president, vice president.
And the reporters folded her notebook up and said, you know, do you know what my editor would pay for that quote? And I said, why? He says, Arkansas, Tennessee. I was like, oh, my gosh.
And so
after that, you just, you know, get over the fact that when you work at the White House, you do two things. You check your ego and your politics at the door, and really get past the ego that people are there not to talk to you. They want to talk about someone else. So just, you know, keep the spotlight on the family.
Yeah. Is it unusual to go from one administration and from one party to another as
you know,
a chef?
It has not been that the case over the years, but there has never been, the only two real sort of statement-making hires were René Verdun, as I talked about, the French fellow.
Right.
And he was let go by the next president, and then Walter Scheib, who brought the American cuisine. And I had fully thought that, having been so clearly identified as Hillary Clinton's chef when the Bushes came in, that would be that.
No, right.
That was no problem. You know, he did 7 years, and that's great. But word came through the usher's office again that not only, you know, were the Bushes interested in having me stay on, that they thought it would be a great idea and were looking forward to working with me. So for the next 4 years, it's a great time, and I get to serve a second wonderful family. And again, as I say, it's not about politics. It's about getting to serve the family.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually you were let go. For what reason?
Well, you know, I tell you, after 4 years, and remember 9/11 happens during this, and Mrs. Bush doesn't get to do much entertaining, and first ladies are people of a certain degree of personality, just like the presidents are, and they want to leave a mark, too. I mean, there's a very finite number of first ladies and finite number of presidents, and they're entitled to, and it's part of their perks, if you will, that they get to leave a mark on the White House or a legacy. And at 4 years in, Mrs. Bush really hadn't been able to establish a legacy. She still had Hillary's chef. They were doing great things, but they hadn't had a chance to entertain. So at the beginning of the second term, which is usually when these things happen, Mrs. Bush decided basically to turn over her whole staff. She let her chief of staff, her press secretary, her social secretary, the executive chef, the whole thing was turned over. And sort of the understanding, although it was never really verbalized, was this was we were going to reinvent the First Lady. We're going to give her a new persona for her next 4 years. And to do this, we need a new team. And clearly, it isn't going to be Hillary's chef doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided that they wanted to have the first female chef, which is great because my wife's a professionally trained female chef, and I'm all good with female chefs. And so they went out and looked all over the country and determined after this 6 month search that the best female chef they could find was a woman I had hired 7 years prior.
Oh, that's nice.
And had been my assistant for 7 years. I trained
great.
Her, and she had been an integral part of everything we had done. So in many respects, even though I'm not there, most of the procedures and practices and the personnel and all the ways we did things are substantially the same. So I think it's the neatest thing. I get to travel around the country and tell great stories at cocktail parties and still pretty much have developed what the White House is doing.
Yeah. 11 years is a long time
to keep up
that kind of pace.
That's plenty of time, believe me, in my business. business, you know, 4 or 5 years is as long as you typically stay in a place.
We welcome more phone calls for Walter. We're talking with Walter Scheib this hour. He's the author of White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents, One Kitchen. He was the chef for those 11 years for the Clinton administration and also for the first 4 years of the Bush administration. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. White House chef, 11 years, two presidents, one kitchen. Walter Scheib is our guest this hour, and we're talking about his wonderful book that has just been released, Cooking for the Families, the First Families, the Bush Family, and the Clinton Family, and cooking for all these amazing events, and watching the White House change after September 11, and what the presidents would do when the first ladies were on the road, how they would kind of change the menu here. We're talking about all of that. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Next call is Christy from Lake Geneva. Hi, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Just great.
Good.
I'm curious about organic food. I've been eating organic 100% for about 25 years.
Oh.
And I'm very curious as to whether or not, while Walter was in service there, how much of the food was organic, and if they ever got any kind of food from factory farms, which is a big horrible thing.
Well, you know, first off, congratulations on being one of the first people into the what is going to become, I think, a national trend of great healthy dining and being paying attention to where the food comes from. But I'm going to give you an answer to this that'll probably surprise you. Mrs. Clinton was always, you know, adamant about nutrition and freshness. But one of the surprises I got from Mrs. Bush a couple weeks into my time working with them, and she called me up and said, "Look, Walter, it's very important to me, because it was this way at the governor's mansion in Texas, that as much as possible, we use nothing but organics."
Mm.
And that really, you know, it played completely against stereotyping. And like I say, getting to know them as real people, she was adamant. And apparently it had been the case. I talked to the chef at the governor's mansion in Texas. She said that had been the case there, too. So we went out, and the few things that we weren't using that were organic, we switched over to those, dairy specifically. And so we had this organic milk brought to the first lady at breakfast one day, and they brought it out. And the butler said, "You know, madam, this is the organic milk that you asked for." And the President Bush is at the other end of the table, sort of smiled and cocked his ear, and he goes, "Laura, organics in my White House? I never imagined it."
Oh.
And she laughs. She goes, "Honey, you've been eating it for years. You didn't even know." So back to the question at hand. Yeah, we used whenever possible and as much as possible. We would use organics. We would, as often as possible, use artisanal growers and makers and gatherers. And our goal was to be on the forefront of wonderful things. And one of the kind of curious stories is that most of these farmers, and there's several hundred of them around the country, don't know that their product ever made it to the White House, because we, for security reasons, had to go buy them through third parties.
Oh.
So that's one of my hopes one day, is to be able to go out and go back to the – I kept track of all the different farmers and go and tell them, "Hey, by the way, we used your stuff. Now tell me about your passion. Tell me why you're raising goats, or why you're doing this, or whatever you're doing."
Oh, yeah, and then do a book about that, Walter.
Well, you never know. We'll see.
Sure, that'd be great.
To all your listeners to buy this one, they'll give me another one.
Okay, thanks, Christy, for the call. Ellen is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
My question is, I was wondering where you found all the recipes that you used.
Well, I have cooking is a lot like music, I think. There's a certain number of notes that are out there and chords that are out there. It's how you recombine them and how you put them into the most apt setting. I have a cooking library of about 1,500 volumes, and we had probably 25 or 30 different chefs that worked at the White House that were all top-level chefs that would work on a part-time basis with us. So I'm a big believer in, you know, really sharing and letting people kick their 2 cents in. So we spent a lot of time, you know, if we were thinking about an upcoming dinner, really talking about it, thinking about flavors and what was going to be good at that time of the season. And many times it would start out as an idea, and we would start doing the tasting dishes and look at them and decide we didn't want to go that way. And it would sort of morph. And so it really was an ongoing process. And I tell you, when we'd finally do the dinner, we'd have the plate a certain way. And then the next day we said, well, we should have done it a little bit this way or a little bit different that way. So nothing is ever perfect, but we get our inspiration from a variety of ideas and cookbooks and ethnic cuisines from all over the world.
Thanks very much for the call. Did either of the Bushes, the kids, I know you talked about Chelsea doing some cooking, did they ever come into the kitchen and do their own cooking, the First Lady or the President's?
Well, no, not to my recollection. No. They may have, but they had their own private kitchen up in the residence. We typically weren't up there except during meal periods. And so if they got up in the middle of the night or wanted to, you know, put something together, they may have done it. We had the fully stocked kitchen for them. But for the most part, their schedules are so daunting and so busy.
Right.
I doubt that they did.
Right. Gregory from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I'm enjoying the show.
Good.
I got a burning question. It's just been burning for years that I watch, you know, news. And whenever they report on these state house dinners, I've often wondered, when dignitaries come in to the White House to eat, and I know people are all, you know, you got your security measures in place and all of that, but is there ever times where they actually come in and they don't eat, and your work of art tends to be more of a show piece on the table? And I guess what I'm really trying to say, is there some kind of paranoia about coming in and eating other people's foods, especially if you're a high-profile dignitary?
Yeah, I expect there probably is. And I can't go into what the president and the first lady do when they're on the road, but suffice it to say they're very secure. But in the White House, I can't recall anybody ever not having what they want. As a matter of fact, in many cases, they were looking for seconds. And, you know, Helmut Kohl, the German chancellor, was always complaining that we never gave him enough food, so we ended up giving him more. But, you know, you're absolutely right. The concerns for wholesomeness and being sure that nothing happens unduly, the Secret Service takes their job very seriously. They do an exceptional job. We work with them everywhere we could to make sure that that was never a problem.
Hmm.
Was there, if I could ask one more question.
Sure.
Let's say Muslim, or what has been probably the hardest meals to prepare in terms of?
Well, I'll tell you, the way it works, when we're ever doing a state dinner, we have a guest from another country, whether it's a state dinner or not, we get something from what's called the State Department Office of Protocol, and that outlines the religious needs, the health needs, the personal needs of the guest, of the principals. And we really work to make sure that we go out of our way, whether it's halal meats, whether it's kosher, that we go as far as we can. But even more than that, if it's just, you know, that President X doesn't like garlic, well, we don't use garlic for his plates then, you know, or if he's on a, you know, lactose intolerant diet. And these days, as you know, everybody has something that they don't eat anymore. So getting that and being sure we custom made it for that individual is the way we would address it.
Mm-hmm. So of all the, I'm sure you get this question all the time, but I have to ask it nonetheless, of all the wonderful dinners, there must have been somebody who you just really admired, who you respected, and you couldn't wait to serve them a perfect kind of meal. Was there a dinner like that?
Yeah, I think there really was, and I think it's really a fairly easy answer, and it's Nelson Mandela. When he came to the United States in his first visit after being released from prison and being elected to the president of South Africa, gigantically charismatic man. You look at, you know, I admire people that do things that I couldn't do, and to see someone who was so calm and peaceful and serene after having gone through what he was forced to go through, just an amazing individual. And he was one of the few people that ever actually asked to sort of address the staff and the folks that worked at the White House and sort of hold an audience for a variety of people. Just a spectacular honor to be around the guy. There's a number of dinners. You know, it's hard to say what would be the most, but the one that sticks out in my mind is getting a chance to meet him.
I would imagine. Do you remember what you cooked for him?
Or? Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, the entree that day was something, again, that President Mandela had very simple taste, having been in prison for 30 years. That'll do it.
Yeah,
but
I imagine.
We did something. He loved fish and he loved vegetables, so we made a wonderful lightly crusted piece of halibut, and the sauce was just as simple as could be. It was carrot juice reduced down, a little tiny bit of cinnamon, and a little bit of nutmeg. So very fresh, very light, very nutritious, beautiful color. Again, people always assume it's going to be some great ornate presentation. It's not. It's getting those flavors out there.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Gregory. Phone lines have been busy. If you want to get through, you could right now at 800-486-8655. Kim is next from Lake Villa, Illinois. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm fine. I just want to ask your guest, I would like to hear a wonderful, inspiring story about what President Bush likes to eat.
Well,
I've heard a lot about the Clintons. I've heard about the what President Clinton had, wanted to eat while she was gone and everything like that. I just want to hear.
Sure, I'll tell you, the President Bush, a wonderful man to work with, a man of fairly simple taste, but he loved what he loved. Very, very big into any sort of Southwestern flavors. Loved beef tenderloin. I think one of his favorite dishes was when he was in residence and not at Camp David or Crawford. After they'd come back from church on Sundays, almost without fail, it would be huevos rancheros with red beans and rice. And very, very simple, you know, simple Mexican-style food, but loved it. Always fresh tortillas with it, you know, wonderful fresh eggs. Enjoyed that sort of thing. Loved enchiladas in general. Anything that was full flavored, a little bit spicy, these sorts of things, what he really enjoyed.
Home cooking.
What's that, Kim?
Home cooking.
That's, well, yeah. Most everything we did, you know, you get away from the state dinners and all the fancy entertaining. You know, day in, day out, it's a private family, and they have their Mrs. Clinton was funny. She said, you know, Walt, you can make all the fancy food you want, but at Thanksgiving, if I don't have my Pepperidge Farm bread stuffing, there's trouble. And it's, you know, it's the same with both families. They have
things that
they've grown up with and they want to see, and that's really our goal, is to make sure they get as many of those as possible.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Would you go back, no matter, I know you're very close to Hillary Clinton, but would you go back to the White House, or is it, you've done that now?
Well, you know, it's funny. My personality is such that if you're asked to serve by a president or first family, you're kind of bound to do it. You really don't have a choice. But my thought is I'd have to check, you know, people ask if Mrs. Clinton wins, what would you do? I said, well, I have to check with the first gentleman now to find out if I can still know how to make the ribs and all those wonderful stuff that he enjoys eating. So, but I don't know. The business is going well. I enjoy it. Chris, my successor, is doing phenomenally. You know, it's speculative on a number of levels.
Yeah. And let me give you a number one more time. We have time for maybe one more phone call. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. Was it okay to have written this book? Have you heard from the Bush family, from the Clinton family?
No, not at all. I tell you, people ask that all the time. Did I have to sign some sort of release? And, you know, quite honestly, my honor and my word to the families and the honor of serving them, you would never, you know, having been with them 11 years and gotten as close as you did, you would never want to do anything that would be embarrassing or off color or put them in a bad light. There's really, you know, millions and millions of great stories. The press has raked through all the other stuff themselves. I leave that to them. It was my honor and pleasure to get to know them and get to serve them. So the last thing I would want to do is say anything that would be embarrassing or distasteful to them.
Yeah. And I would imagine after all those years, Walter, you really get to know each other, don't you?
Yeah, you do, in fact. You know, when obviously I'm not on a first-name basis with them, but when they're on a first-name basis with you and they ask about your kids, I know each year at the Christmas party at the end of the holiday season was so busy that first ladies would always thank my wife for, quote-unquote, lending their husband to them for a month, you know. So they do, in fact, appreciate very, very much the sacrifices you make both personally and professionally to be there.
Yeah. And what about your eating? Did you ever have time to eat? Would you eat what you made for everybody else?
Well, typically that's what would happen. Both first ladies had a tendency to want to be on diet, so I would always put myself on the same diet that they were on. So, you know, a couple weeks down the road, the first lady might say, well, you know, chef, I haven't lost any weight on this diet. And I say, well, I'm that's curious, madam. I've lost 9 pounds. And they say, well, maybe you should take the apple pie out of the refrigerator. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of back and forth and very good natured. And again, to see them both at very, very positive times, you know, to see the interaction between the husband and wife and the daughters and the extended family, to get to share all those good times, and at the same time to be there to try to help in any way you could when the times weren't so good.
Yeah, exactly. The first ladies you mentioned were on diets. The presidents were not?
Oh, yeah, the presidents were on, they were on the, what do we call the seafood diet, seafood needed.
I guess you do when you got a job like that. That's a good joke. Well, Walter, you were delightful. Thanks so much, and thanks for writing the book. It's just, it's so well done.
Well, thank you much.
Yeah. Our guest this hour, Walter Scheib, you spell his last name S-C-H-E-I-B, and the book is titled White House Chef, 11 Years, Two Presidents, One Kitchen. He has quite a background. He graduated from the Culinary Institute of America, served as chief chef at major hotels and resorts before coming to the White House, where he was one of 4,000, can you believe it, 4,000 applicants to be the chef at the White House. He now runs the American Chef. If you want more information about that, there's a website here that you can go to. It's theamericanchef.com. American Chef, all one word. His company offers catering, cooking classes, and culinary talks that draw on his White House experiences. Plus, this book is also filled with recipes of special dishes that were cooked for the Bush family and also for the Clinton family. Isn't that amazing? Doing all those meals for 11 years. 11 years. That's quite something. So that's that story. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks also to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. This show will repeat tonight at 10 o'clock if you want to tell somebody about it, or you can get a copy of the hour by calling the radio store. That phone number is 800-747-7444, 800-747-7444. The program number of this particular hour is, what's the date, 26E, 26E. And just a little announcement I want to tell you about, because I know there are a number of educators who are listening, or people who know educators who are listening, teachers, et cetera. For those of you who are in the Milwaukee area, this is something you may want to partake in. The Milwaukee UNICEF store office has been in our community for nearly 20 years. It's closing now, and UNICEF has all kinds of materials that they are giving away. This is why I'm making the announcement. They're giving these materials away free, particularly to educators. They've got posters and videos and print resources, and they're particularly good for multicultural settings. So call the store if you would like to get more information about this. The UNICEF store is 414-774-3830, and leave your name and number, and a UNICEF volunteer will call you back and set a time to come to the store. Thanks for listening.